Welcome back to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or leave your comments on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're speaking with journalists about the week's news, and we're so pleased to be joined today by Lana Vajanos, a gender reporter at HuffPost who covers gender and politics with a focus on sexual violence and activism, and Amy Littlefield, who is the nation's abortion access correspondent and a journalist who focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. So welcome, Lana and Amy.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
So on Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments over a Mississippi law that bans abortion at 15 weeks of pregnancy. Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization has been called one of the most important abortion cases in decades, one that reproductive rights advocates say could greatly erode or overturn Roe versus Wade, a landmark decision in 1973, which legalized abortion in the United States and affirmed it as a constitutional right. So given the Supreme Court's six-justice conservative majority today, many are now asking what the future of women's reproductive rights is going to be in this country and what can be gleaned from Wednesday's hearing. So we're so pleased to be joined by the two of you to discuss this. And since the hearing, many have been trying to figure out what the oral arguments, particularly some of the questioning by the six conservative justices, will mean for how they will ultimately vote on a decision that will be forthcoming next June. So we're going to have a long time to wait to find out whether or not Roe versus Wade is going to be explicitly overruled, or what seems very likely, at least gutted or restricted in its scope. And so I'm just curious to hear from both of you, and Elena, let's start with you, just what you came away with from Wednesday's hearing.
Yeah, you know, I think that while we all knew that there was maybe a conservative majority on the court, I was pretty surprised to see, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, with the questions that they asked. They definitely asked a lot of questions that suggested that they are willing to whether overturn Roe or kind of tinker with gestational limits, which is what the Mississippi ban is talking about. It's a 15-week ban. I was definitely surprised, I think, how obvious it was that, you know, Roe is really in peril right now.
And Amy, what was your take away from the Wednesday hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the three justices that Donald Trump appointed to the court were put on the Supreme Court with the explicit mandate to overturn Roe v. Wade, right? That's what he wanted them to do. And so I think there was a lot of skepticism over, wow, will they really do that? Because it could threaten the legitimacy of the court, and it would come, you know, before the 2022 midterm elections. And could it really be considered, you know, politically palatable for them to do it? And I think what we saw on Wednesday was evidence that the conservative justices don't really care about public perception as much as people maybe thought they did. I think, you know, the question from Amy Coney Barrett around the implication that being forced to give birth in a country with the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world is not really a big deal because you can just drop the baby off for adoption at the nearest, you know, fire department. That sort of shows where her head is on this issue. So, you know, I agree with Alana that it really is a moment to take stock of the fact that Roe v. Wade is clearly in peril. And I think we should also pause for a second to remember that for the past 3 months, you know, the state of Texas has been able to implement a ban on abortion in the earliest stages of pregnancy that has sent people from that state, you know, traveling as far away as California in order to access abortion and left an untold number of people unable to get that care. That's because the Supreme Court has allowed that law to continue, you know, for the last 3 months. And so, you know, we didn't need the arguments in the Dobbs case necessarily to show us how far they're willing to go to restrict abortion access.
Well, and Amy, you mentioned that these justices, you know, according to Republicans, President Trump, were basically put on the court for this moment to overturn or at least severely curtail Roe versus Wade. But at the same time, you know, when you heard now Justice Brett Kavanaugh in the confirmation hearings, he described Roe as settled law. Susan Collins, the deciding vote to confirm him in the Senate, sort of famously said that she had assurance from him that he wasn't going to overrule it. Now, we could be cynical about this, but did you find it surprising, or do you still anticipate that he will follow through on his sort of pledges there at, during the confirmation process, or were you surprised by his attack in this oral argument?
Right. I mean, but Brett Kavanaugh was the justice during the arguments on Wednesday who decided to list a whole bunch of previous cases that the Supreme Court has used to overturn precedents, right? And said, look at all these other cases where we've, you know, overturned precedents. And wasn't it a great thing that we did that and that we broke with, you know, historical precedent on these issues? And really, he seemed inclined to do it again. He also implied that the court would be neutral on the issue of abortion, potentially if struck down Roe v. Wade, which, you know, is sort of something that legal scholars, I think, across the board have rejected. So it's I think it's pretty clear that now that Kavanaugh is on the court and has made it past, you know, his confirmation hearing, we're seeing that the sort of ideological vetting of these justices, you know, ahead of time before they got to that place is really paying off for the Christian right.
And Alana, was there anything surprising to you that came out of the question and answer? For example, Chief Justice Roberts often tries to play a sort of middle ground role, tries to be a little bit of a break on the court getting too aggressive, and has done so famously in some cases, like the decision to ultimately uphold Obamacare. Were there any indications or surprising comments from him or other justices that you took note of?
Yeah, you know, Roberts was the one who essentially said, you know, he asked, is a 15-week viability, you know, it's kind of arbitrary, the viability line, and to move it and to overturn 50 years of precedent, he seemed to suggest that it wouldn't be a big deal. And I think that's what a lot of abortion advocates are rejecting, this idea that, you know, if we just the viability line is not something that we can just tinker with without essentially overturning Roe and effectively blocking access to reproductive rights and abortion care for millions of people across the country.
And Amy, you mentioned what the ramifications are going to be at the state level. And so if Roe versus Wade is overruled, or if this 15-week viability mark is a sort of limit here, what do you anticipate is going to happen now in the states? And I note that the Guttmacher Institute says that 2021 is on track to become the most devastating anti-abortion state legislative session in decades, just given the number of restrictions that states have begun passing. So what would you anticipate happening at the state level across the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. And not only was 2021 a record-breaking year, but, you know, states have that are opposed to abortion, or with legislatures that are opposed to abortion, have been preparing for the end of Roe v. Wade for many years. And so the Guttmacher Institute says that basically if Roe falls, there are 26 states, so about half the country, that would be certain, if not very likely, you know, to overturn or ban abortion. And that includes a dozen states that have these trigger laws that would basically ban abortion immediately in the event that Roe falls. So, you know, if we think about what's happening in Texas, which is this sort of slow rolling crisis where people from Texas who are seeking abortions have had to fan out across states, all across the country. They've filled up so many appointment slots that there's now weeks long waits in states like Oklahoma, where Texas patients are flocking. So it's affected really places way beyond the state of Texas. And that's one state. And it's not a total ban. It's a ban, you know, on abortion at about 6 weeks. So there are some people who have been able to get care before then. So I think it's really sort of hard to fathom, actually, what that is going to look like.
Well, and we know from polling that the United States is still a predominantly pro-choice country in terms of public sentiment. And many of these laws, it was easy for Republicans to pass them at the state level because they weren't going to be put into effect because of the Supreme Court decision. And Alana, just to go to you on this, do you think there's going to be a political pushback? Is this the proverbial dog catching the car? And now Republicans have to deal with, you know, what could be perceived as very politically unpopular draconian restrictions on individual freedom here?
You know, I wish I could say yes, but I think that at the end of the day, these very extreme legislation that we've seen on the state level since 2011, really restricting access to clinics and to abortion care, it's playing to the base of the Christian right. And I do feel that a lot of times that's where the power lies. I do think that we're going to see whether Roe is overturned or gutted in some way, or if it's not. I do think that we have to, the abortion advocates are going to have to really mobilize. And I think we've seen that with abortion funds and other organizers, practical support groups who are helping people seeking abortion care travel across state lines through abortion clinic deserts where there's no clinic for. I think that we're going to see more people relying on grassroots organizing versus the actual government, because at the end of the day, it's failed time and time again to deliver this very, very integral piece of healthcare that many people use throughout the country.
So, Alana, you anticipate trying to essentially get women who don't have the means to travel outside of states to, you could almost liken it to free state and slave state in terms of the patchwork laws governing this freedom here for folks facing unwanted pregnancies. So you're envisioning kind of smuggling them out, essentially. Of course, there's also the risk that states could criminalize people who leave their states to travel out of state to get an abortion. Would you see that as something that could be on the horizon for various states to pass?
1,000,000%. I think that if one, as Amy was saying, SB8, the Texas 6-week ban, really galvanized extreme anti-abortion advocates, and it really gave them the go-ahead. And I do believe that this conservative majority on the Supreme Court is not only, undermining the legitimacy of the court, but it's also reminding this base that they can go ahead, they can do what they need to do. They can implement these restrictions. They have the support. So I definitely see that, this is a very slippery slope we're on. We've already seen an onslaught of abortion restrictions over the past few years, especially, but once we open that gate, it's a long road ahead, and I can see, I think the next step would be traveling interstate travel. It's going to be medication abortion via mail, which Texas actually just heavily restricted Thursday, less than a few hours after the Supreme Court oral arguments happened on Wednesday. So there are already restrictions in place to further and heavily restrict abortion care once or if Roe is overturned.
If you're just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we're discussing the Supreme Court oral arguments that took place on Wednesday in a Mississippi abortion law case that could potentially lead to Roe versus Wade, the 1973 decision that made abortion a constitutional right across the country, could potentially overrule that decision or severely restrict it. We're very pleased to be joined by Alana Vajanos, a gender reporter at HuffPost. She covers gender and politics with a focus on sexual violence and activism. And also joined by Amy Littlefield, the nation's abortion access correspondent and a journalist who focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. Amy, we've talked a lot about the Christian right as being the sort of prime movers and shakers here behind these mm-hmm. laws. Can you describe a little bit about how they've mobilized and what their campaign has been to get us to this point?
Yeah, I focused in a recent piece in particular on one organization that really forms a sort of legal engine behind a lot of the Christian rights agenda, and that is the Alliance Defending Freedom. They're an organization that started out in 1994 as sort of the Christian rights answer to the American Civil Liberties Union. They were trying to create a group that would be capable of sort of advancing the agenda of the Christian right in courts and state legislatures. And they've been massively successful over the years in building a powerhouse organization that drafts model bills, works with their allies and state legislatures to get those bills introduced, defends that legislation in court and often all the way up to the Supreme Court, funds the cases they don't represent. And they've trained legions of, you know, thousands of lawyers who are part of their network. A lot of folks who they work with have gone on to high positions in the Trump administration, in state attorney general's offices. So they're very well connected. And this is actually the organization Alliance Defending Freedom actually wrote the model bill that became the 15-week ban that is now before the Supreme Court and going to give the Supreme Court the opportunity to end legal abortion as we know it. So it's really important, I think, to look at the driving force behind these efforts and also to acknowledge that Alliance Defending Freedom is the same organization that is responsible for another trend we've seen this year, which is the record number of anti-transgender bills in state legislatures across the country. So they have also been the force behind bills that are aimed at preventing transgender students from being able to play on sports teams or use the bathrooms that correspond to their gender identity. So I think it's really important to draw the connections, you know, because the progressive movement tends to sort of work more in single issue organizations and silos. We don't always see the connections, but for ADF, these issues are very intimately connected and part of sort of a wider project of advancing a Christian right narrative and, you know, weaponizing the issue of religious freedom for a whole host of priorities that are really sort of at this point in lockstep with the Republican Party.
Well, and Amy, you make the point in the article and just now about how this has divided the left with bringing up issues not just of abortion, but transgender rights. Do you think this could lead to a counter movement by folks on the left that could essentially unite a lot of these sort of issues of individual rights, of morality, to unite them to counter this Christian right movement that we've seen with so much success take hold in this country?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's already happening. You know, I think that the reproductive justice movement increasingly has really brought a sort of expansive, holistic framework forward that looks at, you know, the issue of LGBTQ rights, the issue of abortion rights, the right to parent, the right to have, you know, the supports that you need to, you know, survive and live safely. And so I do think that there is an emerging awareness of how all of these issues are connected. And I think there needs to be more of that because it's true that the Alliance Defending Freedom in particular, you know, really counts on these sort of divisions. And they've actually funded purported feminist organizations like Women's Liberation Front that are really out there specifically with the agenda of attacking transgender people. And they're sort of in lockstep with ADF. And I think that has allowed some of this language, anti-trans language, to creep into feminist spaces. Whereas if there was more alliance building on the left, you know, that wouldn't necessarily be possible.
Well, I want to also let our listeners know that if you want to join this conversation or if you have questions or comments, we would love to hear from you. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. We'd love to hear from you if you have questions about Wednesday's hearing, if you listened to it and you have thoughts to share or just thoughts about what the reaction to a potential overruling of Roe versus Wade might be in this country. We would love to hear from you again, 866-798-TALK. Well, Alana, you mentioned the Texas law. I think many are familiar with SB 8 now, which essentially puts a civil penalty on folks who either get an abortion or help someone get an abortion. But you also just mentioned something that I think has not gotten as much attention in Texas, which I know you've been covering, around essentially criminalizing or making it a crime or a penalty to get a pill to have an abortion. And, you know, that was a question that I had originally hearing about some of these bans, that can technology essentially solve this issue? If people can receive abortion pills in the mail, then maybe it doesn't matter so much about closing clinics, although, of course, that does still harm access, but maybe not to the same degree. So can you talk a little bit more about the future of sort of abortion by mail and what this Texas law might pose for going forward?
Sure. So currently, medication abortion is the most popular form of abortion, for lack of a better phrase, when you go into a clinic. And it's usually given with pills in two different settings. And it's a very easy and accessible way for people to get abortions. But what has recently happened is people are able to access abortion pills via mail. And in Texas specifically, they severely restricted it to ensuring that now there's a 7-week ban on abortion pills in the clinical setting. And they also criminalized with felony charges for any doctor to write out a prescription and send it via mail, courier, or delivery. So the reason that this is such a big deal is that, you know, the way that anti-choice lawmakers have really cut off access to abortion care is by implementing restrictions that make it very hard to either get to a clinic, or, you know, when it comes to 24-hour waiting periods in between talking to a doctor and actually getting your abortion, or, you know, invasive ultrasounds that means that you have to come not to a clinic once, but twice. And again, going back to what we were talking about before, you know, if the closest clinic to you is 6 hours away and you have children, which the majority of people seeking abortions already have one child. So it's really hard to get to a clinic, not only once, but twice. Maybe you don't have paid time off. Maybe you aren't able to get time off. So abortion pills really are kind of the next step to allowing people access in their own home, on their own terms, in control of the setting that they are getting their abortion in. So that's definitely the next step. And we've already seen states like Texas, and I'm sure other states are going to start restricting that access, since we're already having, you know, after the Dobbs v. Jackson case, this is kind of the next step of restriction that I think we're going to see.
Well, I mentioned earlier about the politics of this and how the country is largely pro-choice. And Amy, I wanted to ask you about what Congress could do here. If there is majority support, could Congress just pass a law to essentially enshrine Roe versus Wade? And I would note that you don't see a lot of Republicans really celebrating here, which I think is somewhat indicative maybe of the politics of this issue. But I'm curious what you would see as potential legislative responses at the federal level.
I mean, there hasn't been a federal piece of legislation to expand or affirm abortion rights in decades. Congress, you know, could, of course, take up this issue. The Women's Health Protection Act has been passed by the House. I believe, you know, that's a law that would enshrine, you know, the right to legal abortion at the federal level. There's also a bill that Barbara Lee is a force behind that would lift the Hyde Amendment, which is the, you know, decades long ban on federal funding of abortion that has basically created a two-tiered system where most people on Medicaid can't get access because it's not paid for with federal funding. So, yeah, there are efforts in Congress, but it seems like there is not the political will among Democrats to really force through those measures with any urgency. And I think it's important to also look at the fact that abortion has been part of a wider Republican project that also includes voter suppression and gerrymandering and capturing control of state legislatures, where all of the action or almost all of the action on abortion rights has been for decades. And so the potential for political change, I think it's going to take a lot of movement building and a lot of work on the abortion rights side.
And Alana, we just have about a minute left here. So a final question for you. I'm curious what you think are going to be the next steps here if Roe versus Wade is overruled. And I would also just point out that we did hear some discussion in the Supreme Court oral argument on Wednesday about a potential nationwide ban on abortion, potentially rooted in the 14th Amendment. Just wondering if you have thoughts about that or any other next steps that you would anticipate to think about going forward.
Yeah, I mean, going forward, if they had banned abortion outright and they don't recognize it as part of the Constitution, that also sets precedent for, you know, not recognizing gay marriage, because it's not physically written into the Constitution. So there could be much larger issues as well if we go down that road. And I think additionally, what I've seen prior and what Amy's actually written about a lot, which I definitely urge you to go read her piece in the New York Times. It's really great. It's going to be at the state level. You know, the power is going to be reverted back to the states. We're going to see attack over attack at the state level. And I think it's going to come down to grassroots organizations on the state level that can really be on the ground with people who need access to abortion care and can actually help them day in and day out. And I think that's where the future is here.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both for coming on and discussing this issue. Alana Vagianos, a gender reporter at Huffington Post, thanks so much for being with us on Your Call, Alana.
Thank you.
And Amy Littlefield, the nation's abortion access correspondent. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much.
So that's all the time we have for today. But to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. And follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email any show ideas you have and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.